This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. As soon as he took office, President Joe Biden made a commitment to develop and expand the use of clean energy. With offshore wind power being a major part of the plan, New England becomes a pivotal player. This week, a number of key decisions were scheduled to be made that will shape how our region gets its energy for years to come. WSHU Assistant News Director and reporter J.D. Allen has been following efforts to create wind power in the area, and those efforts have been blowing through this region long before Joe Biden took office. J.D. joins us from the WSHU News Bureau at Stony Brook University on Long Island. J.D., hello.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Pretty well, thanks. Thanks for taking time today. There seems to be quite a bit of activity aimed at installing wind turbines off the Atlantic coast, including Long Island. So let's start there. Who are the players, and what do they want to build?
Tom, there's a big patchwork of different projects that are being considered or in different stages of development. You have the South Fork Wind Farm, which is going to be developed by Ørsted and Eversource. Ørsted's that Danish wind energy company that has done a lot of work over in Europe, and Eversource, which is in Connecticut's backyard and all of New England as an energy provider. They have a pretty sizable wind farm that is pretty close to getting its regulatory approval to start planning on how it's actually going to bring wind turbines out into the Atlantic Ocean.
And as the name suggests, it's off the South Fork of the island, yes?
Off the South Fork of Long Island, off the Hamptons, as it's popularly known. And that has had its own difficulties about getting this project off the ground, or rather in the water. There are some wealthy Hamptons residents that live there part-time, some folks who live there full-time, that although they support green energy and clean energy that wind turbines would bring, they don't want it in their ocean. They complain about the visual impact that this could have on them. You know, these are 800-foot tall turbines in a lot of cases.
And how far offshore would they be? How visible would they be?
Yeah, so the South Fork Wind Farm is staged at about 30 miles off the coast. So they'll be small on the horizon, but visible on a clear day. And then there's some other considerations that need to be made about how do you bring that power that's being generated off the coast 30 miles back to shore to connect to a substation, and that's through transmission cables. And there's been some dispute between local governments and the state government and the federal government with local residents about, you know, whether or not these transmission cables that will be carrying this high power are going to be coming across the coast, oftentimes buried under their beaches to substations nearby.
And before they get to the actual shoreline, they're laid along the ocean floor?
Yeah, they're going to be laid along the ocean floor. In some cases, they might also be turned over and buried some, depending on the underwater topography. You know, all of these wind companies and wind developers are starting to look at different ways to put these turbines out into waters. I mean, the ideas that have been put forward over the last couple of years, not one are the same. It's not like there's an industry standard quite yet. Some are planned to be, you know, stuck down into the ground, you know, feet under the water. There are some that might even be have legs of its own underneath the crest of the water, and that could be a little bit more sizable under the sea. And then there are others that are saying, well, maybe we don't have to drill down into the sea floor to keep these things steady. Maybe we can use like some kind of buoyancy. And it's going to be really interesting to see how these companies are going to figure this out, because, like I said, not one of them have the same plans in place. It's kind of like if you're buying a personal computer and you're trying to plug in a different charger into your laptop.
So there's the South Fork project, Ørsted and Eversource getting together on that. Are there other projects that are in the works off the coast of Long Island?
Yeah, so the Biden administration had put forward at the end of last month five new leasing areas between Long Island and New Jersey. These leasing areas oftentimes are, again, 30 miles off the coast. There were a couple of that were signaled for 15 miles off the coast, and that has those communities that are worried about the visual impacts quite upset right now. In fact, two of those that were off the Hamptons, Fairways North and Fairways South, were ditched last week by the federal government after hearing concerns from New York State as well as local government officials.
And are there any others that are as far along in the process as South Fork? The areas that are up for lease, first of all, is that a bidding process? And second of all, does anyone own those leases yet?
Yeah, nobody owns these leases yet. So the leasing for these projects are expected before the end of the year. These new leasing areas right now are just plots of water. You know, right now there might be commerce that shipping that goes nearby. There could be commercial fishing that happens in these leasing areas currently. But right now, it's just ocean. And later this year, the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is going to start putting these plots of water up for bid to energy companies to start putting forward their projects.
I'm talking with WSHU's J.D. Allen, assistant news director and reporter who's been following efforts to create wind power in our region. You mentioned the fishing, commercial fishing industry a moment ago, JD. There's been some opposition. You've reported on some opposition from that industry when it comes to these wind turbines. What problem do they have with these kinds of projects?
So the fishing industry all up and down the eastern coast has been really skeptical of these plans and actually just outright enraged about these plans because they've been trying to tell developers and the federal government and any state government that's going to listen that a lot of these leasing areas are in their prime fishing ground where they have found success with fishing in their industry for decades and decades. And by leasing out some of these areas, it's going to potentially displace the fish populations that they're aiming for. And it could really make their industry much harder. And the pandemic has already impacted them so much. I spoke to Bonnie Brady over at the Long Island Commercial Fishing Association, and she estimated that the commercial fishermen that she represents, over 90% of the business that they relied on at New York City restaurants and markets were abandoned pretty much during the pandemic. So they've been reeling and now are going to be reeling for decades to come if these turbines go into those prime fishing locations.
What about Connecticut? What's its connection to the wind farms? Connecticut has no offshore Atlantic areas. It does have Long Island Sound, and I'm assuming no turbines are planned for the Sound. So what is Connecticut's connection to these projects? How would the state benefit from them?
Yeah, nobody's got any ideas yet for any turbines in Long Island Sound. They're still kind of guessing or checking, rather, whether or not it's even feasible to have them there. So a lot of the consideration in Connecticut in terms of offshore wind has been about the industry in constructing and operating these offshore wind farms and the industry and the commerce that can come from it. So there are two harbors, very popular harbors in Bridgeport and New London, the New London State Pier, for instance, that are looking at ways to connect to these offshore wind developments to help stage the construction and the operation of these projects. And they might have some luck pretty soon.
So they'd be hubs, essentially, bringing material and ships and workers to bear on the projects.
Absolutely. They need that skilled workforce. They need areas with the manufacturing capabilities and the transportation capabilities to be able to, you know, put up these 800-foot-tall wind turbines with blades that weigh tons and tons and tons. So these harbor communities that have histories of strong industrialization in the area are looking at new ways to get a part of this clean economy.
Have you been able, through your reporting, to get a handle on who benefits from the electricity that would be produced by these wind farms? Is it local communities on Long Island, Connecticut, further afield than our region?
Well, the best part about wind farms off the coast is that everybody can benefit. So obviously, like I said, there's the industrial benefit that coastal communities can have, and there's the educational benefit that comes from training that skilled workforce. But then in terms of the actual power that comes, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of homes being able to be powered by this clean energy. 1 gigawatt is enough to power about 374,000 homes. President Biden's plan is to bring 30 gigawatts of power, with most 30 gigawatts of offshore wind power, with a lot of it poised for New England waters.
Now, one of the big projects that we know about is one that is being put together by Vineyard Wind, which would be a wind farm off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. And this week, you mentioned the Biden administration's plans. There's supposed to be possibly a decision made on the future of that project. Could you tell us a bit about that and what the possibilities would be if it's approved, the next step, or not?
Vineyard Wind has been waiting for years and years for some kind of regulatory signal that they can move forward on their project. And over the last 4 years, they didn't get that signal. But President Joe Biden is moving forward with and his administration is expected to move forward with 10 more approvals of offshore wind before the end of this year. And if Vineyard Wind, which is scheduled to be the largest and first real offshore wind farm for the United States, it would give the signal that they would be able to start some of their, at least onshore development later this year. And that means communities like Bridgeport and their harbor would be able to benefit in the staging of that construction.
So it's quite a tangled web of complicated connections here to make all this happen. Has anyone given you an idea of when any wind farm would actually be producing power that could be used?
Well, the goal right now is to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 50% from 2005 levels before 2030. So in order to get to that point, there has to be some construction and operation of these wind turbines to make that happen. In terms of getting these projects started and constructed and operated and tested and connected to the grid and being able to, you know, give energy to hundreds of thousands of homes across the Northeast, it's going to take some time. Probably not this year will we really see those benefits, but in years to come, Biden's hope at least is that we will.
There's one more question I wanted to ask you about opposition. Is there any so-called green-on-green opposition to these projects? Again, creating clean energy is a green goal, but sometimes with these kinds of projects, there are other effects on other parts of the environment. Is that the case here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about putting, you know, hundreds of these turbines out off the coast. And off the coast, that means, you know, there could be drilling and construction work, and that means additional, you know, vessels bringing in people and crews and all the tools that are required to get this job done. And that could have a really, it could have severe consequences on the environment that are being tested and are being looked at, but this desire to put clean energy, renewable energy, offshore wind energy out into the waters, you know, there's this momentum that some environmentalists are excited about and ready for, and other environmentalists are like, wait, hold on, how are our research vessels going to be able to track, you know, endangered populations like the whales or like dolphins or other marine life that, you know, we've been tracking now for years with the construction and operation of these turbines out in our waters? You know, what does that mean for our ability to watch and preserve the ocean that we've sought to protect?
JD, thanks so much for your reporting on wind power in our region. We'll be checking in with you again, I'm sure, a number of times this year
I'm
as
sure.
These projects move forward or don't. But again, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
J.D. Allen is WSHU's assistant news director and also a reporter who, as I mentioned, has been following the creation of wind power in our region. We're taking a closer look at the future of wind power in our region. The wind is, of course, a renewable source of energy that could help meet the electricity needs of residents and businesses, bring in jobs, and help the environment. It's a win-win, right? Well, it's not necessarily that simple. Offshore wind turbines would not be welcomed by everyone. On Long Island, some environmentalists worry the turbines will impact marine life. The fishing industry says they'll disrupt their best fishing sites. And some folks just don't want turbines within view or have cables running under their beaches. Is there too much downside to wind power? Adrian Esposito, the executive director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment, is here to talk about that, and she joins us on the phone. Ms. Esposito, welcome back to The Full Story.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Certainly. Your website says your organization, quote, works to advance responsibly sited offshore wind development, which stands up to rigorous environmental review and includes meaningful public participation opportunities. I'd like to ask you first, what is that environmental review? How does that work?
Well, actually, wind power goes through a very localized but also a federal environmental review. So under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, there are public hearings. There's a determination of the different elements that would be studied, that are studied, such as impact to birds, impact to the benthic region, which is the bottomlands of the ocean, impact to migrating fish and marine mammals. There's a very long list and criteria that each offshore and also on land wind farm are subject to. So there are ample scenarios and opportunities for the public to have their voices heard in this process.
Are there specific environmental concerns from that list that you're paying closer attention to at this point, the ones that concern you more than others?
Well, I'll start out with the one that concerns me the least, which is seeing, you know, your wind farm.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, last I checked, I can see power plants on the land. I see the Northport power plant. I see all the power plants because they're on the land. And those people that are upset by seeing windmills, you know, I find that to be, frankly, a little contradictory. So we have to, unfortunately, get used to seeing where our power comes from. Electricity infrastructure is not invisible. Also, with wind farms, most of them are being sited 15, 20, 25, and some even 50 miles offshore, which means there is no way a person can see those wind farms when standing on shore. Some of them are below the curvature. They end up being around the curvature of the earth because they're so far out to sea. So these visual impacts are really overblown, overstated, and unwarranted. What we do want to make sure happens is that wind farms are not put in migratory bird flyways or pathways. So we know more about this than we did 20 years ago. And now each wind farm, they're required to have 3 years of data. Birds flying through the airspace both during the day and in the evening. So we have a robust data set of bird migratory habits. And the second thing that we worry about and we make sure to be careful about is marine mammal pathways. And that, I have to say to you honestly, the wind companies, the vast majority, have been very sensitive to, and we're happy to be able to report that. One wind company, Ørsted, the Equinor, has come to a terrific agreement with some of the national environmental groups about how to mitigate any impact to migratory whales, particularly the right whale, which is the most endangered species on the planet. There's only a couple of hundred of them left. So we need for wind companies to work in partnership with the environmental agencies and also with the environmental community to site these structures in the most sensitive way. But let me say this, and I think it's very important for listeners to understand this. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that the greatest threat to birds, marine mammals, and our fisheries is climate change. Climate change is actually responsible for killing more birds right now and changing the ecology of the ocean in a way that is having a massive impact on survivability of finfish, shellfish, and also changing the patterns, migratory patterns of marine mammals. So on a big scale, we have to remember and bear in mind that we need to transition from fossil fuels, which are damaging the earth and impacting wildlife, to the clean, safe renewables, which will mitigate climate change and help restore a healthy ecosystem in the ocean.
I'm speaking with Adrian Esposito, the executive director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment, located on Long Island. With these things in mind, the rigorous process through which these projects are reviewed and the willingness to listen to various groups and individuals have to say about them. This week, the Biden administration announced that the federal government will not lease to potential wind power areas off eastern Long Island, off the Hamptons, the Fairways North and Fairways South sites. I believe they were planned for 15 miles off the coast. And there was some controversy over these sites, especially in connection with the fishing industry. Do you agree with the decision to pull those leases off the table?
I think that's a good decision. I mean, that's what this process does. That's exactly what the process is supposed to do. Look, we want to be as sensitive as possible to the commercial fishing industry. You know, we have a lot of respect. That's a hard job to have. But we also need for the commercial fishing industry to understand we need to share the ocean. You know, 80% of the globe is covered by ocean waters, and we now need to use little sections of that ocean for wind farms. So I think that NYSERDA and BOEM, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, made a good decision. They deferred to the commercial fishermen that they felt those were prime fishing grounds and would be too disruptive to their work. We get it. Let's take them off the table. Let's focus on the vast amount of bottomlands that we do have, and we can develop for offshore wind farms.
You also mention on your website that New York cannot achieve its renewable energy goals without offshore wind. Why is that?
Well, the goal right now, or actually the commitment, I should say, is by the year 2035, which is only 14 years away. It's not a long time. New York wants to power 6 million homes with offshore energy, and that equates to 9,000 megawatts of power. We cannot achieve the goals of the climate change bill that passed in 2019 unless we include offshore wind. Yes, we need solar. Yes, we need battery backup. Yes, we need, you know, other forms of renewables. But honestly, offshore wind is the new infrastructure that can create large-scale renewable energy for us. And look, you know, people say to me all the time, well, you know, this is that and that, and, you know, it could have this problem. Here's the answer. All forms of large-scale energy production have some impact on our environment. But it is our responsibility to choose the forms of energy production that has the least impact on our environment, and that is offshore wind and renewables. And that's what we're fighting for right now. That's the goal. You know, with this wind industry, we're going to create more green jobs. We're going to stabilize electricity rates. And we're watching a historic transformation right now. It's actually rather exciting to see us really begin to be able to shut down antiquated, outdated fossil fuel power plants and replace them with cleaner, safer, renewable infrastructure is a turning point for New York, but also for America. And that's how we're going to fight climate change. That's how we're going to clean up our air. That's how we're going to reduce asthma attacks and particulate matter and heart attacks by really making this transition. We can do this, and I'm happy to say we're on our way.
Ms. Esposito, thanks so much for your time today discussing offshore wind power.
Thank you again. I appreciate the ability to talk about it.
Adrian Esposito is the executive director of the Citizens Campaign for the Environment on Long Island. In my conversation with WSHU reporter J.D. Allen, we mentioned the state of Connecticut has signed contracts with two companies involved with major wind power projects. One is offshore of Rhode Island. That's Revolution Wind. Its land base, its staging area, would be in New London's port in Connecticut. Second one is with Park City Wind for an offshore Massachusetts project with an onshore operation that would base in the port of Bridgeport in Connecticut. Some say that's just the beginning of the state's stake in wind power work. We want to understand from the state's perspective what these projects would bring to Connecticut. And we have with us today the Commissioner of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, Katie Dykes, and she joins us via Skype. Commissioner, welcome back to The Full Story.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, certainly. Well, the Bridgeport and New London sites are both, of course, onshore hubs in those ports where the parts for the offshore infrastructure would be built. Will these projects contribute to zero carbon sources of electrical power for Connecticut?
These projects are going to be the cornerstone of our path to reducing emissions from our electric grid here in Connecticut and around New England. That's why we're so excited about, what offshore wind represents. This industry was something people were just talking about in theoretical ways, 5-10 years ago. And here we are in 2021. President Biden just announced this morning an ambitious target to slash greenhouse gas emissions by up to 50% across the country. We're already on track to be achieving a nearly zero emission electric grid here in Connecticut because of our leadership on climate and especially because of the investments we've been making in offshore wind.
When do you think that these two projects might begin to contribute to Connecticut's power?
Well, we expect these projects will be coming online in 2025. These are massive infrastructure projects. If you think about it, the turbines that we're talking about here that will be producing power off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, one turbine will be the size of the Chrysler building. So these are, again, major engineering projects. It takes many years to get them deployed and in place. And they're going to create a lot of jobs and economic activity in our state along the way. So we're really excited about that.
Commissioner, you mentioned the Biden administration activities this week when it comes to green energy and other related topics. I'm wondering, is the Biden administration's focus on wind power now speeding up the timeline for the completion of these two projects we've been talking about?
Well, it's coming just in the nick of time. We have, set the wheels in motion at the state level by having ambitious clean energy targets and by, Governor Lamont, moved the process forward that enabled us to sign contracts with these two projects. the Vineyard Wind project and the Ørsted project that are combined going to supply 20% of our electricity from offshore wind here in Connecticut. And these are the largest renewable purchases that have ever been made in Connecticut's history, represented in these contracts. So, but that we need a federal partner because the federal government needs to do its part to address permitting and environmental reviews for these projects because they're located in federal waters. And so we're, you know, really pleased that leadership at the Department of Interior and at the Department of Energy and across the federal government are recognizing the transformative potential of offshore wind to move forward with those environmental reviews that are critical to keep these projects deployed on time. And you know, at the same time, just getting the these turbines built is just the beginning of opening up this offshore wind opportunity. We're also going to need to construct enhancements to our transmission system to make sure that these clean electrons can get from the ocean to our consumers, and so that they have a clear path to flow onshore and direct to the ratepayers of New England. And at the same time, we know that there's going to be a lot of opportunities around port infrastructure development, workforce training for the high-skilled jobs that are going to be required to deploy and maintain these offshore wind turbines. And, you know, Tom, we also have a huge opportunity to leverage our precision manufacturing talents and industries here across Connecticut to begin to move into producing the parts and those supply chain aspects of offshore wind. That's going to be a win-win for our economy, for growing jobs and activity, economic activity in Connecticut. But also, the more we can build offshore wind components right here domestically in the U.S., it'll be even more affordable to tap into these resources as opposed to importing those components from overseas.
I've heard there's quite a bit of competition at this point when it comes to producing the elements, the parts needed to put these turbines and other aspects of the project together. Do we know that Connecticut will have a leg up on the supply chain as opposed to it coming from other states, other countries?
Well, the good news is that I know the federal government is very interested in helping support states and support industries here in the U.S. to be major players in offshore wind. That represents a real sea change from the last administration. So I think there's a lot of possibilities of tax incentives and loan guarantees and other types of support coming from the federal government that will help boost our Connecticut industries to really capture this opportunity. I know that Connecticut certainly is getting the benefit of competition when we're signing contracts with offshore wind companies, and that's because we've had a commitment over the last decade to use competitive RFPs that are run by the state to get the best price for the offshore wind projects that we're contracting with. And in fact, we've seen a 20% drop in the purchase price of offshore wind over the last 3 years when we've been doing these RFPs. So that means we're getting more clean energy at a lower cost to ratepayers. So, you know, we're excited about this opportunity and again, helping tap into federal dollars as much as possible to boost our local supply chain, as well as using the benefit of competitive procurements to get the best deals on offshore wind for our electric ratepayers.
Connecticut electricity customers, you mentioned ratepayers, they have among the highest utility bills in the country, I believe. And I'm wondering, will wind power affect the cost for consumers down or up? Connecticut has a goal of sourcing all of its power from zero carbon sources, I believe, by 2040. Does that mean between now and then, as that zero carbon source pool goes up, the prices might go down that we see on our bills?
Right. So we know that we need to dramatically reduce emissions from our electric grid in order to avert the worst impacts of climate change. You know, every investment that we make in reducing emissions now, you know, the cost of those investments are minuscule compared to the enormous costs that we will be paying if we don't avert catastrophic climate change impacts, especially in the latter part of the century. So it's You know, that's one thing to keep in mind. At the same time, you know, again, we're using every tool that we have to lock in emission reductions at the least cost possible. That's why we've been utilizing competitive procurements to select offshore wind projects and make sure that ratepayers get the benefit of the least cost possible. Our commitments in Connecticut and across the Northeast to building out offshore wind has also sent a strong signal to the marketplace, to those offshore wind developers, to invest in technologies that will help deliver more renewable power at a lower cost. So we see things like new turbines coming out that are even more efficient and can produce more power per turbine. That means lower costs for consumers. So we're doing everything we can, and by sending that signal to the marketplace, they're helping to drive investments in technologies that are bringing the cost down over time. At the same time, another thing that I'm laser focused on is making sure that Connecticut ratepayers are getting full credit for the offshore wind and all the renewable and emission-free resources we're investing in at the ISO New England. The ISO New England is the operator of the regional electric grid that we share with the other New England states. Unfortunately, the ISO, they've designed a market that, you know, embeds certain preferences for fossil fueled resources, and they've been applying, you know, rules that create barriers for resources like offshore wind that states have been investing in to get full credit in the ISO New England market. And what that translates to for the average ratepayer is duplicative costs. So while we've been procuring hundreds and thousands of megawatts of offshore wind over the last couple of years, the ISO New England's markets have given the New England ratepayers credit for only 54 of those megawatts. So that's something that, you know, most people don't hear about, you know, every day. It is one of those kind of more arcane kind of technical issues, but the rules matter. These market barriers really matter because it can cause ratepayers to have to pay twice or pay for duplicative resources that we don't need. So it's something that we're working hard on behalf of the ratepayer to the state to make sure we get credit for every single one of those megawatts of offshore wind we're building. And that's a way for us to ensure we're not paying for duplicative energy costs.
I'm speaking with Katie Dykes, the Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. The benefit of a good strong wind is spinning turbines, and something that's not a benefit of a good strong wind is the one that blows through the state and takes down the poles and the trees and the wires. I'm wondering if there's any connection with shoring up that system as we look at an infrastructure that would need to carry this clean energy that we're talking about in the future.
Yeah, that's a great point. So listen, you know, we know that we're experiencing the impacts of climate change already in our state and around the globe as a result of the delays in getting carbon reduction policies in place. And so, all right, you know, ratepayers are starting to see that in their bills. They're starting to see that in the impacts of these storms, like we experienced Tropical Storm Isaias last year. You know, these are once in 50, once in 100 year storms that we're now seeing every 5 and 10 years. And it is extremely costly for the district, our electric utilities, to rebuild all of those poles and wires to reconnect service when we have these intense storms that come through, not to mention the challenges that you know, our residents and businesses experience in terms of safety and, other economic challenges when the lights are out, when the power's out for a prolonged period of time. But so these are just everyday examples that we're already starting to see of the costs of climate change. And so it's really important that, again, we have to make these investments in reducing emissions as quickly as possible. This is a critical decade that we are in. We, you know, the choice is this is the last chance that we have to significantly reduce emissions and avoid these impacts of climate change becoming much, much worse in the decades to come. And so that's why we have to invest in resources like offshore wind, renewables, energy efficiency, shifting to electric vehicles. You know, all of these are strategies that will help prevent these costs from becoming worse over time. At the same time, you know, resources like offshore wind are terrific because they produce power on a pretty consistent basis especially in the wintertime when we have some grid reliability challenges because the natural gas power plants that the ISO, the grid operator, relies on sometimes can't get access to natural gas and run reliably, especially during periods of really cold winter weather. So this is another example where offshore wind resources actually can enhance and contribute to the reliability of the electric grid. But the greatest value that they're providing is helping prevent climate change from becoming catastrophically worse.
In traveling around the region, I occasionally see one or a handful of turbines that are land-based. I think there's one right near New Haven Harbor, as a matter of fact. I'm wondering, we're talking offshore wind projects, but are there any plans for onshore turbines or some kind of a situation that would involve these projects, you know, not being located in the water?
Mm-hmm. So Connecticut, we do have some land-based wind turbines that have been developed up in the Colebrook area, up in Litchfield County, for example. But generally speaking, our richest resource, our greatest potential for generating electricity from wind is located off of our shores. There's certainly land-based wind resources in northern New England, far up in Maine and Arista County, for example, is a really rich area for land-based wind resources. But those resources you have to build a lot of transmission to bring that power from up in Moose Country, you know, down to Boston, to Hartford, to Providence, to those places where we have a lot of the demand for electricity. By contrast, offshore wind resources are located relatively closer to where most of the people live in New England, and so it requires less miles of transmission to connect it to customers. And that's one of the reasons that one of the many reasons that we've seen offshore wind really taking off. But we're going to need all of these resources in order to power a fully decarbonized electric grid. Large-scale hydropower from Canada, keeping our nuclear resources operating, dramatic investments in energy efficiency, solar, both solar on your rooftop and grid scale solar projects, as well as land-based and offshore wind. It's going to take, you know, our best opportunities to have a clean grid will involve a investment in a portfolio of these different resources, as well as emerging technologies like battery storage. So we're excited about how innovators and industries are coming together to make these technologies available and affordable. That's how we're solving climate change.
Does 100% of electricity from zero carbon sources by 2040 mean that the nuclear plants will continue to operate?
Well, Tom, we're going to be 91% emission free in our electricity supply in 2025 here in Connecticut. And when you add up all of the contracts that we are ventured into with emission free resources, 20% of that being offshore wind, a very significant portion of that also being from the nuclear facility, the Millstone facility in Waterford. We just completed a detailed analysis at DEEP of all of the different pathways that we have available to us to achieve a 100% emission-free electric supply by 2040. And, you know, it's clear when we ran the analysis, we looked at lots of different scenarios with our nuclear resources continuing to operate, or a scenario where the nuclear resources go offline. It's pretty clear that the most affordable path that we have to an emission-free grid in 2040 will involve those nuclear resources continuing to operate. But alternatively, if they shut down, it will mean we'll need to build a whole lot more renewable resources to replace them. And, you know, there are some important trade-offs to consider that could be a little bit more expensive path. It will also, you know, there's more possibility of siting and environmental land use conflicts that could emerge as you think about where we would put all of that solar, the amount of offshore wind we would need to build. So we have to take all those different things into account. And certainly our analysis points to the retention of nuclear resources enabling us to achieve a deeply decarbonized grid with lots of renewable resources in the most affordable way.
I have one more question, not directly related to wind or renewables, but I'm wondering, did the pandemic change how Connecticut residents used energy, where it needed to go, and did that in any way impact your planning for the future?
So, you know, we've seen a lot of changes that have occurred over the last year, certainly with a lot of folks staying home and staying safe, a real positive contribution to helping prevent the spread of coronavirus. We saw a lot of folks working from home and shifting to telework. It points to the importance of infrastructure like broadband and how critical that's been as a public health solution over this last year, but also to the importance of having reliable electric service. And many folks who've been working from home, you know, saw that their electricity consumption increased during this time, and while commercial use leveled off. So we don't know if that will be a permanent trend. I think a lot remains to be seen. But another interesting thing that we saw that occurred was on the transportation system, that we saw a significant drop off in vehicle traffic on our interstates, but actually more traffic picking up in local driving that's been occurring. So, you know, a lot of these patterns have illuminated for folks, you know, just about people have kind of, you know, discovered kind of new ways of working. We'll see what becomes permanent. But I think that it's awakened people to the importance of sustainability and thinking about, you know, other types of changes in behavior, new ways of working, new ways of moving around, new ways of consuming electricity, enhancing energy efficiency, things that we can take with us, you know, into a post-pandemic future to improve sustainability and address climate change. And, you know, we're excited about the Transportation Climate Initiative program, which is something Governor Lamont's been a champion of. This is a program that would drive significant investment over the coming decade in things like electric vehicles. And we've done a lot of advanced planning for our electric grid to make sure that we're prepared to meet the demand of more and more vehicles plugging into the grid to continue to provide emission-free electricity to power those vehicles. So it's an exciting time. There's a lot of change coming, but I think it's really positive change. It's going to improve air quality. It's going to improve economic activity and grow jobs, and most importantly, help us to address the climate crisis for generations to come.
Commissioner, thank you so much for sharing the state's perspective with us regarding wind power. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Katie Dykes is Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. New London is one Connecticut city that could get a significant economic boost from the Biden administration's focus on wind energy. The city's State Pier, not far from where the Thames River flows into Long Island Sound, is a proposed site for an estimated $200 million project to create a wind power hub. Joining us now is the mayor of New London, Michael Passero, joins us via Zoom. Mr. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. How does the proposed State Pier work in your city connect with wind power?
That's exactly why the state of Connecticut and Orsted and Eversource are investing up to about $230 million right now in infrastructure to support the assembly of the wind turbines that will go in the offshore lease areas.
So the actual construction, to some extent, of the equipment that would eventually be located, I believe in this case, off Rhode Island, a ways out, a lot of that work then would be actually done in the location that we know as State Pier.
Exactly. New London Harbor is situated perfectly and has the characteristics necessary to assemble these huge wind turbines. They can be up to 30 stories tall, and our harbor is has no height restrictions and is completely open for the huge vessels that it'll take to transport the assembled turbines out to the lease areas where they'll be installed out in the Atlantic Ocean.
in terms of not only height but width and I guess depth in that area of the harbor. There's enough clearance so that those very large vessels won't have a problem getting in or out.
Exactly. As you know, we also host the submarine industry currently Electric Boat on the east side of the river is also engaged in a very large marine infrastructure improvement project in order to facilitate construction of the new missile class, Columbia class submarines. These are incredibly deep draft vessels. So that the channel in New London Harbor is 40 plus feet in depth. So it can easily accommodate at the same time the vessels that will be assisting with the construction of the wind fields off of the East Coast.
Are these some of the reasons that the site was selected, that New London was selected, State Pier was picked as a proposed staging area for the wind turbines? How did it get selected as opposed to some of the other sites along the North Atlantic coast?
Well, we were first approached by a company called Deepwater Wind, which is the company that has built the first wind energy field off of Block Island, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. So the first six wind turbines on the East Coast were built by Deepwater Wind. They approached us first as the state of Connecticut began engaging in the bidding to purchase offshore wind, and actually Deepwater Wind won the first 200 megawatts of power that that the state of Connecticut purchased, and then they in the zero carbon auction about 2 years ago they won another 100, I guess it's kilowatts, excuse me, of wind power, and they initially approached New London because of its natural assets and the closeness to the offshore wind fields off of Martha's Vineyard, and the natural geographic characteristics of the port, and then eventually Ørsted, which is the largest offshore wind company in the world, out of Denmark, purchased a Deepwater Wind, formed a partnership with Eversource. And they will be staging their construction out of the Thames River here.
How would this project benefit New London?
Oh, it's a whole new industry. I mean, think about it. We're on the cutting edge of a whole new industry that's setting up here in New London, Connecticut. So when you talk about the jobs, the supply chains, career opportunities, it's the economic multiplying effect of this will be transformative. And you really, while the offshore wind industry is in its infancy, in the United States, you can look over to Europe and some of the small towns over there in England and in Denmark that have a 10 or 20 year history of supporting this industry in Europe. You can see the economic boost that it provided to those areas, and we're expecting similar economic benefits here in New London, and for the whole region. Really, it's not just restricted to the city of New London. The whole region will benefit.
There have been some critics of the project, some who said that the jobs that will be created will be mostly part-time and temporary.
Yeah, if you do any research on the industry in Europe, I don't believe that's accurate. Mm-hmm. We're talking about long-term sustained jobs. These wind turbines need continual maintenance even after they're established. So you have the initial temporary jobs, which are the construction jobs, the assembly jobs. But if you speak in temporary, it's going to take 10 to 20 years to build out these wind turbine fields offshore. So I mean, that's essentially a career for people. But then the turbines will have to be maintained. So you have, you know, all sorts of technicians and engineers. You have the crews and the ships to transport the employees to do this work, you know, operators. You can go on and on and on. And then you have just the shoreside services to support the industry, you know, just your typical accounting and marketing and regulatory personnel. I mean, you could go on and on and on. The employment that will coincide with this industry establishing itself here in southeastern Connecticut is will be substantial.
There were also some comments about the flow of some of the cargo possibly having to be diverted and carried by trucks for part of its trip to delivery once this proposed project is up and running.
Are you referring to the displacement of the traditional bulk break cargo?
Yes.
That was coming into New London?
Correct,
and
yeah.
Is now going to either Providence or New Haven? Yeah, that was, you know, that was a trade-off. We do envision the port in between construction phases for the turbines that we would be able to accommodate traditional cargo. But it was a trade-off, and I think you could look at the historic uses of the port over the past century and compare the projected, based on that history, the projected future economic benefits based on traditional cargo, and then compare it to the uses here for wind. And, you know, we believe, and when I say we, I mean the city, the state, really the region, everybody seems to be of the opinion that, and I think it's correct, that this is the highest and best use of this port in this particular region of the country, rather than competing with the cargo industry from, you know, New Jersey, New York, Providence, even New Haven. We've got our own niche now here supporting the offshore wind industry, and it will bring much greater economic benefit to us.
How far along is the project right now? I know there was a public hearing last month. Where in the timeline is the project right now compared to when it could be up and running?
Well, right now it's on target to be up and running by the summer of 2022. And I believe that's realistic. The permitting process, the hearings that you referred to, are at the stage of final briefs to the hearing officer. I'm not exactly sure when we can expect a decision, probably within the next month or two. In the meantime, preliminary work is going on at the pier currently to prepare for the actual work, on the water side, that of course is awaiting the official permits. But we're optimistic that the project will be in full swing this summer.
And when we talk about the work, we're not talking at this point about the actual assembly of turbines. We're talking about the work that needs to occur at the pier to accommodate the future work on turbine assembly, correct?
Right. The first stage and the first jobs will be construction jobs. Mm-hmm. It's a $235 million infrastructure improvement project to the actual pier, so that we'll have the heavy lift capacity necessary to support the construction of the turbines.
Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for your time today, letting us in on what's happening with State Pier in your city. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Michael Passereau is the mayor of New London. If you have an opinion or a story you would like to share with us about wind power, you can email us at tfs@wshu.org. And we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangaray and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.